Welcome to Circular Firing Squad. I'm Marty Gentius, a counseling faculty at Kent State University and host for Circular Firing Squad. We've got five members, five questions, and five answers for each question. Each squad member generates a question that we all have to answer, ranging from the scholastic to the bombastic. Let's see who's with us for this episode.
Hey, everybody. My name is Mitch Conrad, otherwise lovingly known as the ketamine guy by at least five of my peers right now. I'm a graduate student at Cleveland State University.
I love that it has a completely different context to the ketamine guy I knew 20 years ago. I'm Steph. I am a doctoral candidate at Kent State and a practicing clinical counselor.
Hello, I'm Britt Pollard-Kozanowski, professor and grad coordinator at Indiana University of Pennsylvania.
Hi, everyone. Elliot Ingersoll. I'm a professor of counseling at Cleveland State, host of Apply Topically.
So, Mitch, you've got the first question.
Yeah, let's go. So my question is, what surprises you most about counseling students nowadays?
It's funny because we had a conversation that can give me an answer to this question in my little text friend group. Maybe last week or so, because I am not around a lot of counseling students very often. Right now I'm holed up in my office writing, or I'm working with clients. So to that, it was brought up about how many of the counseling students are not necessarily expecting to remain in counseling for the longevity of their career. This is like a first career, something like that for the new ones. I think obviously, later on, you know, it's something that they want to stick to more. But the 20-somethings perhaps are just, they plan to do this for a little while and then switch to something else. So I think that's interesting and surprises me a whole lot that people are kind of looking at to this as an intro career. I don't know.
I've been seeing some of that too, Steph, and it's really sort of thrown me for a loop as well. I've also seen students increasingly throughout the program questioning, is counseling even what I thought it was, what I want to do? Is this a fit for me? More so than I think I've ever seen it before. But the initial answer I thought of to this question was what students are bringing to the table these days. I cannot believe in the 10 short years that I've been teaching, how much has evolved, I guess, sociopolitically, socioculturally, and how students have just evolved right alongside that. It blows my mind thinking back to what a baby I was when I was doing my master's degree, and nowhere near anything that my students are coming up with in terms of interests and things they know about and things they have questions about. So that's just been really fun for me to watch. And I look forward to another 10 years and seeing what's happening, you know, at that point down the road.
There were two things that stood out for me. And one is the students have excellent bullshit detectors, which I just so appreciate. And sometimes it gets a little carried away, but I'm like, well, you know, that's all right. But far more than when I was, you know, getting my master's, they will question things. And I just love it because it really livens up the dialogue in the classroom. And the other thing is just the body art, the ink. It's just amazing. I love how people express themselves with it. Like when I was growing up, if you weren't a Marine or in a motorcycle gang, you didn't have ink. You know, it's just, that was the thing. But yeah, it's just that that's broken open too. But I think their ability to question things and kind of an enthusiastic engagement of to thinking critically. I love that.
Boy, I answered this question differently. I took a different approach to it. And what came out of me was seeing students increasingly, there's a need to do. So they want to know how to do something. They don't want to be something. And I see it happen a lot where, yeah, but what do you do? You know, how do you do it? And so I think, you know, where the field is going in terms of MI, CBT, DBT, those are all kind of doing practices, and then, you know, we sit down and I'll do a demonstration or like, did you do that? How did you think to do that? And it's sort of like, well, I spent a lot of time studying stuff at one point in my life, but I also spent a lot of time learning how to be, not just do. And so at the same time, I mean, they want to know how to be able to do that. And it requires a different thing than learning all the things that you can do or reading the manual or having the right handout for the client. Then ironically, all they want to talk about is mindfulness, which is like, oh yeah, we need to do more mindfulness. Yeah, well, that's, you need to start being instead of doing. So a lot of you were very kind with your responses. Mine was just kind of, this is what I'm seeing coming in. Everybody wants to know how to do, and very few people want to know how to be.
Yeah, I'm going to thank you, everybody, for your answers. I'd like to, you know, comment on yours, Marty, because I think it was really insightful. I definitely experienced this myself, sort of the pull between the being a counselor versus the pull of like doing the job of a counselor. And I think that coming into the program that I felt very much more like being, and still do now, like I definitely feel that being aspect of it. And I noticed that they're right. Like I do notice that push to sort of like do things. How do you specifically implement something? And so like, it's kind of an interesting balance for sure. So the thing that that surprises me is more of, I think, generally just in the field of counseling itself. As someone who, right, was not, you know, I was never in a counseling program before recently, and I'd never really seen the other side of it. I'd never worked inside of a counseling location or anything like that. And I have been somewhat surprised by the level of confidentiality that people keep with client stories and client experiences. And so I think of confidentiality as very, very sacred and secure. And so for me, I don't really like to talk about anything that my clients say outside of counseling. And I sort of like came into, you know, academia thinking that that was the norm, actually, that counselors like don't have too many conversations about like maybe like something mundane that their client did or something like that. Right. Like, no. And this confidentiality thing is not like relevant to like, you know, people are like not describing identifying information all the time. It's mostly surrounded about like things that my client has said or things that my client has done. And I sort of like wonder what clients would think about those things sometimes, because I do wonder, like, if, you know, I don't have many issues if my counselor would say, you know, certain things that I said or certain things that I did without giving any identifying information. But I also do wonder how much is appropriate to talk about a client. Obviously, we have ethics classes, but I sometimes do wonder if that when I witness it from certain other people or some other people, right, like most people, I think, are really just not talking about their clients. But I also wonder, like, how much is too much there?
Okay, so here's a doozy for everyone. Here we go. Is this what you expected life to be like?
No. I have thought about this question. I have judged my answers to this question. I have tried to change my answers to this question. And I just can't get there. It's a big fat no for me. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, right? I think at various points along the way, I've certainly had different visions of what my life might become. And I've tried to think about it in a very holistic way in terms of things that have happened to me that I didn't expect. But there's also choices I've made that I don't think I could have expected for myself. Relationships that I've had or not had. I mean, just every facet of what I think I envisioned for myself years and years ago is so wildly different. And there's certainly some probably negative that comes with that, things maybe I wish had gone differently or that I would have done differently had I known certain things. But there's also a lot of joy and happiness and excitement and fulfillment in that. that I couldn't have predicted for myself. But in short, my answer is absolutely not.
Well, for me, yeah, I think it is. I had to grow up real quick because of just stuff that I went through. And I remember reading, I was young, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. And he talks about having this older part of himself that was like an observing ego. And I had something like that. And I remembered, like, oh, I was aware, yeah, life is not fair. It's not just. But there's a lot of the humor. I was in primary school, probably second grade. And this kid, Billy Evans, he was like a class clown. And he had this beautiful shock of blonde hair. And he was just funny. I always hope he got into comedy or something. But he exasperated the teacher. We were having pictures taken. And, you know, they had you crammed into the bleachers. And you're supposed to kind of sit there. And he was just wisecracking. And the teacher says, if you say another word, you're going to the principal's office. So then he starts making farting sounds with his mouth, you know. Brilliantly timed too for a little kid, and the teacher had had enough, and she was going to let him have it, and she swings back to slap him, and he just kind of falls back into the lap of the kid behind him, and she pulls her hand, but not in time because she clips the girl next to him, who was kind of a teacher's pet, and clips her, and then she's like, oh, she starts like freaking out. And at that point, the old part of me and the young part of me, we pushed all our chips in. I was like, no, this is too good. This is funny stuff, man. If this is what life's about, you know, sometimes that's all going to be directed at me, the injustice and everything. But yeah, I just see it as a wild ride that it's like a roller coaster. You know, I signed on and I have been bounced around, knocked around. I've had some fun with it. But it's a wild ride. It is not for the faint of heart. You know, there's probably another universe somewhere, but this four-dimensional existential three-ring circus, this is something else. And the unpredictability of it and the surprise, living is always hitting the surprise button. That's what I feel.
You know, I, not at all was my answer. You know, we all study career theories as part of our job. And as I was growing up and through the early part of my career, it's like, am I in the crystallization stage? Am I in the, what stage am I in? And none of that made any sense, because if I think of the different things that I wanted to do and how it changed through my life, and often it was serendipitous experiences, I finally figured out the meaning to life is in the Three Stooges. That if you see any 22-minute Three Stooges short, they often start out as painters at the beginning, and within 10 minutes, 5 minutes, they're offered a job to be waiters at a hoity-toity party. And for me, that just experience is just the experience of life, that you start out in one thing, and the next thing you know, you're a waiter at a hoity-toity party. And that's the cool part of it. I mean, as you get older, and you know, I can attest to it, Elliot can probably attest to it, the more life you live, the more you realize how serendipitous it is, how fun it is, how adventurous it is. And actually, you begin to regret not being able to have that when you pass on. I mean, all of that stops when we go. And so there's a greater appreciation. You get more and more appreciation for it. And like Britt said, there are some tough parts, and then there are some maybe decisions you'd wouldn't have rather made. But in the long run, it's just a great ride.
Yeah. So Dr. I made me think of a sort of a different way to answer this question, because I've been sort of seeing and thinking about this question and existentially trying to process over the past however old I am. But, you know, something that you said, Dr. I, was the idea of like the surprise button, which is something that I think that I've heard talked about by Alan Watts as well. Right. And this idea that, you know, Alan Watts talks about this idea that, you know, people are, you know, sort of imagining themselves sort of like playing God, and like, what is it like in the afterlife? And they're able to fulfill all of their dreams and all of their realities and everything that they've ever wanted to do. Right. And they say, well, what about a surprise? And then they hit the surprise button. And then they have whatever the current experience that they are having, right? And I'm not necessarily saying that I agree with Alan Watts, but it is a very interesting, or, you know, it is a very interesting concept to me, the idea that we would want to experience a surprise, right? And, you know, and so my thought is always, well, I wonder what happens after this surprise. Do we go back and do we press other buttons, or do we hit surprise again? And, you know, or, you know, because I'd hope that we wouldn't just end up in like a dark room, you know, alone for the rest of eternity. I hope that we get to keep kind of playing around and messing with buttons and, you know, causing chaos in sort of the afterlife command center up there. I think that would be quite fun.
That wasn't so bad, was it? Not so bad. I wasn't going to mention this, but it came up a little bit as far as the idea of making different choices. And I didn't know if anyone had come across the book, The Midnight Library. And okay, I see some nods. So yeah, there you go. Made me think of that. And it's kind of like, yeah, what if you think, I mean, every road, there's going to be obstacles. It's easy to have that hindsight. You kind of feel like that kid be like, if I was at, you know, dad's house, everything would be perfect, you know? And it's like, if I had just made that choice, my life would have been great, but really probably not. But, so I think that's interesting. And I was thinking about this a little bit, obviously, because I came up with a question, but I think it's what I was hoping for in some ways, as far as the broad strokes. I feel pretty content. I feel like I'm in a stable relationship, happy. We have a family, you know, things that I wanted, but I also feel good having. I could have had all of these things and been miserable too. But to feel that way, and the older I get, the more of those broad strokes, you know, come in, and then like more detail get put in, like feeling, satisfied with who I am as an individual. That comes in more and more with age, and accomplishments and things where 20 years ago it felt like a lot of stuff was maybe falling apart, and it life wasn't what I was expecting it to be in the negative way. But at this point, yeah, I think as far as wanting to feel content in life, that's going great. As far as what the details look like, nah, not necessarily, you know, house looks different, you know, might've been a parent at a younger age, but, at the same time, because I'm so content, I don't care.
All right. What is the biggest misconception about yourself that you'd like to dispel?
I thought on this for a bit, but I think it is that I am merely reckless. I am not merely reckless. There's reasons. I mean, you know, my partner has to kind of keep an eye on me here. I mean, you set the driveway on fire one time and you're like, oh, you're like this menace, you know, but there were reasons for that. You know, as a department chair, I bent every rule I could, and we got a lot done. That's how you get stuff done. You don't follow their rules. The rules are put in place to paralyze everything. So you got to bend them, and you got to tweak them, and you got to ask forgiveness rather than permission. I love that. But it was never knee jerk. There was a reason. So I think that was it. Yeah.
Boy, I had trouble with this question, and I thought of answers to it that were bigger than they should be. So I settled on this answer, that I have any formal training in technology. It's all self-taught. It's all out of interest. It's all out of delving in and just learning it because I like it. There are people who have formal training that approach problems completely differently than I do. I think my non-formal training means that I'm really kind of looking at it from a usable standpoint instead of a programming standpoint when it comes to use of technology. I think the other misconception is that I have formal training in technology. I don't, but also that I enjoy teaching others about it or how to do it, because you become tech support for everybody who thinks, because you like it so much, you want to be able to fix everybody else's problems with it. I'm giving a presentation this summer at a tech conference where I'm going to talk about how to stop being your family's tech support. I haven't quite figured it out. It's going to involve some things about, you know, teaching them to have their own agency around technology and teaching them how to use Google to solve problems and things like that. But that's the big thing, that I have formal training in technology, or the biggest thing I could come up with that wasn't too out there.
So let's talk about ketamine. I'd like to dispel this misconception that I somehow do not like ketamine, or that I think ketamine is ridiculous. I actually think that ketamine has an incredible amount of potential. I think that I've mentioned on here before, right? Like about the importance of like having a monitor or a sitter in the room or whatnot. But my biggest thing is sort of like people can use whatever, like ideally I want people to use whatever like healing solution is working for them, right? Is that ketamine? Yes. No. We can figure that out. We can have a conversation about that. Is that something like a different psychedelic medication? Maybe there's no psychedelic medication that like works for an individual person. Maybe someone wants to use, something like counseling, right? Is something that's incredibly therapeutic. Like it doesn't have to be just because like I'm interested in psychedelic medicine that I don't think that everything else like works. I think in fact, like the more that you add in with psychedelic medication, including stuff like ketamine, the more that you add in something like counseling or something like EMDR, or even something like psychotropic medication for certain specific medications, right? We don't want any contraindications, but that it's all part of the greater healing solution, right? And so like, in a way, I kind of am the ketamine guy. I do think it is a solution for people, and I do think it can help heal.
See, the problem is I don't know what people think about me, as far as that stuff goes. I mean, I have my own ideas in my head. I have the stuff that I imagine them saying about me. And I think the few times where I really think people were surprised, it's because they didn't expect me to make change, or to take charge. You know, they didn't, like, I'm thinking of old relationships where they just said I was going to stick around forever. And, you know, I'd say I'm not going to, but they really thought that that was going to be the case. And I would just never, you know, set my boundary and say goodbye. And then I do. And then they're like chasing me down and they're coming back. And I'm like, yeah, you really thought that.
Thanks, everybody. That was a good variety, I think, of answers. I sort of forgot after I asked this question to think of an answer. And so I've been sitting here struggling, and I don't know that I have one, to be honest, and I don't want this to sound like a cop-out, but I'm not really sure I would change misconceptions about me intentionally. I think that I would hope as people get to know me that any misconceptions they have would naturally dissipate by the way that I interact with them or the things that I choose to do. And if they aren't going to get to know me, I'm not really sure that I care that they have misconceptions. So I don't know. I'm sure that I could come up with something more concrete, but it might be inauthentic if I forced it. So I don't know that I would dispel anything.
You're right. What film changed how you viewed the world, and what were some of the changes?
Oh, I hate this question. I hate it because there are so many films. I've got like over 600 films set in my query that I can stream any time I want. So I collect these things. And something that changed my whole view or perspective, it's really hard to say. I put Citizen Kane down first only because once I saw that film and I was in a class and we really dissected that film, I could not look at any other movie the same way. I was always paying attention to shot angles, dialogue. I mean, I was paying attention to all of those parts. So Citizen Kane went down. Did it change my life? No, it changed the way in which I look at media. I wrote down Dr. Strangelove. I wrote down Full Metal Jacket. And then I wrote down A Clockwork Orange and realized that I was a kind of on a Kubrick run there. those films were all kind of mind-bending films for me. But if I think of one that kind of changed my perspective, you'll be surprised at this, Midnight in Paris by Woody Allen. And the one piece of that film is the protagonist is, you know, he has these midnight trips into past times of Paris so he can see all the great artists and he talks to all the great artists. And he falls in love with a woman from a previous time and she wants to go to an earlier time. And the concept there is we look back on previous times with a certain type of romanticism. That when we were actually, if we actually look back at what was going on then, wasn't that great? But we look at the past with a certain amount of romanticism. That message is what stuck with me. And it has not only personal implications, but think of it politically right now, what's going on. People looking back at a time where they thought it was perfect and romanticizing about it, and it really wasn't that good. So that was like one of the films that gave me a little bit of a life lesson. The rest of them are just great cinema. And it changes, like learning physics or quantum mechanics, it changes the whole way in which you view the world when you see those films and learn about all the aspects of those classic films.
So I don't watch a ton of movies. And so this question is, I think, a little easier to answer for me because I don't have the sort of like 600, movies to think about. I typically watch, you know, an occasional movie and then just think about it for a really long time. And so the film that has changed how I view the world recently is My Neighbor Totoro. I've wanted to watch this movie for an exceptionally long time. I love Japanese animated films and it particularly struck me in this film how it related to the feeling of empathy and the process of empathy. So if people are maybe a little bit unfamiliar with the film, you know, I was particularly struck in the famous umbrella scene where it's raining with Satsuki and Mei, older sister, younger sister, right? And the older sister laughed at her younger sister the day before when Mei told her about seeing Totoro, who is a tree spirit in their new neighborhood. And the older sister, Satsuki, finally sees Totoro during the scene for real. She gets it now, right? She finally has seen Totoro. She tells her father, who naturally affirms her experience. And she then pens an endearing letter to her mother in the hospital. You know, and how this relates to empathy for me is I think as counselors, we try so exceptionally hard to empathize with other people. And sometimes we do need to realize the limitations of empathy sometimes. Sometimes we have not seen Totoro the way that other people have. The most important thing to me about this film is that it's really important to try and imagine what seeing Totoro would be like, because otherwise you have a situation where in the movie, the older sister laughs at the younger sister and makes her feel pretty horrible. So to me, that movie was a lesson about empathy and its limitations and also its power.
Awesome. Awesome. Also, just earlier, we were at our neighbor's house and we were watching Howl's Moving Castle. You know,
so a great movie.
Yeah. Just Studio Ghibli represent. So when I was thinking about the answer to this question, I found myself continuously coming back to thinking about The Matrix and how it was brand new when I first saw it in the theater and it blew my mind. And not only in special effects and that viewing experience, but in the ideas that they infused to me, you know, 17 or 18 years old, they were brand new. And I think that the way that it was presented being so new made them stick and made them really stay with you a lot longer. So when you're like, you know, I remember we would always be like, oh, deja vu, they changed something in the Matrix. Now we knew that that was a little bit probably not true, but it made you think more about what's going on and what's going on around you and how things were happening. So I just thought that that was a movie that did change the way that how I viewed the world.
the film for me, you know, there's of course tons of films that have affected me. For me, it's The Petrified Forest, Humphrey Bogart, Leslie Howard, Bette Davis. And it was right. I've loved this for years because I'm just a crazy romantic at heart. And it's just a wonderful story, but it's shot like a play. That is what I loved about it. And I watched it again right before I started getting into community theater. And I had a lot of realizations about, oh, this is what the stage looks like. The proscenium arch is over this cafe in the movie. And I don't know, it gave me insights as to how to approach community theater. And it was very liberating for me. The Petrified Forest, that was the one.
You know, everybody gave interesting answers. One of the things that I realize limits my view of movies is I don't go to anything that feels like work. So when you describe these movies that have essential, essential concepts of empathy in it, or you learned a lot about this or that, or, you know, I even in my collection of films, I don't have a lot of these life story, emotional impasse type. It feels too much like work. I always went to cinema to get away. So if things blew up or if things were fantastic or things were bizarre, all of that was my get away from dealing and listening and having to work to listen to people's problems through the day. So my final question, or the final question per se, not the final shot, is did you ever throw a party when your parents were away?
Oh, Marty, I wish I could make something up right now to be more fun. I did not ever throw a party while my parents were away. And I also didn't go to many like parents going away parties. I think this is mostly because I went to such a small high school. You know, I had a class of 20, right? And, you know, it was such a small school that wasn't really something that was as much on the table. I imagine that I would have had perhaps a much different experience had I been in a larger school, at minimum to attend more things like that. But I'm not sure if I ever really would have put that on. I think that I sort of think about my mom's situation at the time. You know, she was, you know, always someone who was working sort of like two jobs at once. And so I certainly didn't want to make that any more challenging for her by coming home to a to a house in disrepair. But none for me.
No, absolutely not. Never would I ever do such a thing, except that one time.
What's the one time?
It was totally like a sitcom episode where I was home for the summer. I was working my job as a server. And so it was like between freshman and sophomore year of college. And, it was that thing where you tell one or two people to come over. I mean, it was really out of a stick. It was so crazy. One or two people, let's come over. Okay. And I'll get the, nasty stuff like Crown. Like, I don't want to drink Crown Royal, but I learned. But then before I knew it, there was like all of the chefs, everybody at my house. And I was freaked out. But I think it just turned out okay. If anybody knew, nobody ever told me about it. I never heard about it. And I feel like at this point, they can't do too much to me. It's hard to ground me now. So I'm in the clear.
Yeah, my sister and I, we had a King Hell party. I think I was a sophomore. She was a senior. My parents went away. We didn't even try to hide it. We took it out in the backyard. I was playing in bands at the time, so I had a PA system. We were cranking music. We had a keg. And I've always had super good friends and still do. And it was a 2-day cleanup after the party, and they stuck around and they helped with all of it. And we always had a Christmas party at our house Christmas night. And so over the years, all these stories came out, and my parents kind of knew, they kind of figured, but the fact that we cleaned it up and we made it right, that was wasn't the end of the world, but it was a good party.
This question comes up for me because I was listening to a podcast called The Rewatchables, and they rewatch movies that we've all watched at some time. And they were rewatching Risky Business. And the comment about, they made some side comment about having parties when your parents go away, and it brought back a memory. Now, my sister listens to this podcast, and so this might be the first time that, I know it's the first time she's heard this story, and hopefully she skips this episode. My sister was away at college. I was the last remaining kid in the house. My parents went to Wisconsin. I wasn't going to go to Wisconsin, but I had a group of friends. I was an ally, so I had people in my high school coming out to me, and so I had a collection of friends. There was one guy, Henry, who had dropped out of high school for many years, then came back. He was like 22 or 23 and was finishing high school, and he was gay. And so I was going to have some fun that week, and everybody knew I was going to have some fun. I only had a small group of friends. Henry was one of them. But what I did was take Polaroid pictures of the piles of magazines and books and newspapers and things that cluttered up the rooms that people would have access to, moved all of those things into a back bedroom with the intent of using those Polaroid pictures to remind me where things go back in place at the end of the week. We wound up going down to Broadway and Broadway Street in Chicago and going to a gay bar, which I had never been to before. I remember wearing a kimono for that experience. And it was okay. It was not my thing. But at the end of the week, I had to clean everything up, put things back, spent a good deal of time doing that, got the Polaroid pictures, rearranged stuff. I threw the garbage out in our garbage can. That was the mistake. That's where I got busted. Because after my parents came home, they couldn't figure out how me living there for 1 week could generate so much garbage. That's my story of the one time I threw a party when my parents were away. So thanks. That's it. Thanks to the firing squad. I got one more question for you. What word causes you verbal torture when you hear it?
Yeah, so I'm going to select a more universal one, at least one that I've heard is universal, and that's moist. I don't, so there's something about this word. I don't really know what it is. I don't know if it's the oi or the oist or whatever, but it feels a little icky to me, you know, and I like moist things. Like I like a nice, like moist banana bread or something like that. But that's about it for moist.
You took mine because I was going for the low hanging fruit as well. Maybe it would be, I don't know, reprimand. I don't know, something like that.
I think for me these days, it's diversity. It's like a runaway train without a crew on board. I'm just getting so tired of everyone just throwing it out without giving any qualifications about what they intend when they say it.
For me, it was low hanging fruit. I was in New Orleans at Napoleon's, having a muffaletta sandwich and enjoying my meal by myself. And at the table next to me were four college age girls, one who used the word like all the time. Like.
Maybe she was a Pokemon.
I don't know what it was, but that is my.
Like.
Yeah, that was verbal torture for me. And that's the word that I hear so often, and I can handle moist, but throw a bunch of likes in a couple of sentences and I'm gone. Well, thanks to the firing squad, Elliot, Mitch, Stephanie, and Britt for joining us tonight. Look for some of these characters on their podcasts on thepodtalk.net. You can find out more about them at circularfiringsquad.net. And check out the Tech Savvy Professor, hosted by Eric and myself. Eric's not here tonight. He said all the moons have been colliding. He hasn't been with us for a while because this afternoon the power was shut off in his community, and he didn't know if the power would be put back in time for the show. So we missed him. Our theme music is from Ménage à Quoi, Real Swing Shet. That's it for this episode of Circular Firing Squad. Ready, fire, aim.